I'm going to start the show.
Talk Shoe.
Recorded live.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, Pastor Eli James here with another installment of Yahweh's Covenant People. And as usual, my co-hosts, Pastor Ken Gregg and William Fink, we're going to continue our series on the book of Hebrews. And we're going to be dealing with chapters 9 and hopefully 10. Both of these are two very long chapters, and they deal with the exclusivity of the children of Israel and how actually the entire Bible is addressed only and exclusively to the Adamites, the seed line, the Israelites and Shemites, that is our people. And the book of Hebrews actually goes a long way in making that case. When we were discussing the book of Galatians, it was a little more difficult because there are some really horrible translations in the book of Galatians. But in the book of Hebrews, it's pretty obvious that Paul is talking to Israelites exclusively and to nobody else. And we've been establishing that through the first eight chapters of the book of Hebrews. And we're going to continue now with chapter 9, and hopefully we'll get both 9 and 10 in on tonight's show. First of all, though, I want to just let everybody know, if you have any questions or comments for me after the show, if you're listening to this show on the archives, my email address is eli-james@sbcglobal.net, and my website is anglo-saxonisrael.com. Again, I'll repeat those two, eli-james@sbcglobal.net and anglo-saxonisrael.com. Okay? anglo-saxonisrael.com. And Bill, you want to give out your information?
Yeah, sure. My email address is WMFINCK, William Fink, at Christogenia, christogenia.org.
Okay. And your website?
Christogenia.org.
Christogenia. Okay. And Pastor Gregg, your email address?
It's JewsKillChrist@yahoo.com.
Okay, that's JewsKillChrist, and that's present tense, K-I-L-L, right? JewsKillChrist@yahoo.com?
Right.
Okay.
Over and over again.
Oh, yes. And if he were to come again under the same circumstances, they would do it again, no doubt. All right, let's continue now with the book of Hebrews, chapter 9. Then verily the first covenant had also ordinances of divine service and a worldly sanctuary. Now, of course, Paul is talking about these ordinances that primarily are addressed to the priesthood. But also, maybe I should ask you, Bill, what are these ordinances? Because ordinances are not necessarily the commandments and the judgments. What are we talking about here?
No, these are the rituals that are commanded of the Levitical class of priests.
Okay.
That Paul's describing here as the ordinances. They're all the temple rituals and the sacrifices necessary to propitiate for
right.
wrongdoing by the children of Israel.
Yes.
And all of the cleansing rituals, which is baptism when you talk about cleansing people, and all of those other rituals that the Levites performed.
Yes. Okay, very good. And the worldly sanctuary, of course, he's talking about the physical temple and also the inner the tabernacle, etc. Let me just keep reading because he talks more about it. Verse 2, "For there was a tabernacle made, the first wherein was the candlestick and the table and the showbread, which is called the sanctuary. And after the second veil, the tabernacle, which is called the holiest of all, or usually called the Holy of Holies, which had the golden censer and the Ark of the Covenant overlaid round about with gold, wherein was the golden pot that had manna and Aaron's rod that budded, and the tables of the covenant," okay, and the Ten Commandments, of course, okay, "and over it the cherubims of glory shadowing the mercy seat, of which we cannot now speak particularly in detail because they're not there anymore. They weren't there in Paul's time either. Verse 6, now when these things were thus ordained, the priests went always into the first tabernacle, accomplishing the service of God. Okay. Any comments from you, Pastor Greg, so far?
No.
Okay. Because what Paul is simply doing here is he's describing the way in which the priesthood operated. He's simply recapitulating. And, of course, this would be familiar to his hearers, or maybe it wasn't entirely familiar to his hearers. What do you think, Bill? Who's this book of Hebrews being addressed to?
Well, it's addressed to the circumcision, and everything here is exactly familiar to his hearers.
Okay.
They're familiar with their own traditions, just like we're familiar with the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence.
Right.
These are all the relics of the founding of the nation of Israel.
Right. So he's not talking to outsiders. He's talking to Israelites who are familiar with the history and traditions of the house of Judah.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. And he's certainly not talking to so-called Gentiles of the non-Israelite world, because they would have no understanding what he's talking about. because he's addressing these people as if they were familiar with these things, just as he has in other books where he talks about being under the cloud, namely when the Israelites left Egypt under the cloud. And certainly, he's talking to Israelites who remember these things as part of their heritage, okay? So verse 7, but into the second went the high priest alone once every year, not without blood, which he offered for himself and for the errors of the people. Okay, so again, he's talking about these rituals. He's certainly not talking about the whole law in terms of anything that had to be changed. Verse 8, the Holy Ghost, this signifying that the way into the holiest of all was not yet made manifest, while as the first tabernacle was yet standing. Okay, so here it's in verse 8, it sounds like Paul is beginning to talk about the transition from the ritual law into the Holy Ghost inhabiting the new temple, the new tabernacle, which is us. Okay, isn't this what Paul is getting at?
Right. He's saying that all these things are a model for the future, meaning the body being a temple, because we really don't need a physical earthly temple.
Right.
And we don't need to communicate with Yahweh, our God. He doesn't live in a temple the way an idol does.
Right, right. Although he used to, because as Pastor Greg pointed out last week, that was only a temporary arrangement, because apparently our people couldn't figure it out any other way.
Yeah, well, that's a good analogy, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's continue. Which was a figure for the time then present, in which were offered both gifts and sacrifices, that could not make him that did the service perfect, as pertaining to the conscience. So obviously, what we're talking about here is these ritual sacrifices, the sacrifices and oblations, could not make anyone perfect. And there's probably numerous reasons for that, but certainly when you're committing sins and having to offer sacrifices to redeem those sins or pay the penalty for those sins, that means that the people are still sinning, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And, yeah. And it was a temporary conciliation.
Yes.
The term mercy, back in verse 5, the term mercy seat, that word mercy seat means seat of propitiation.
Right.
Which is appeasement or conciliation.
Right.
And that was just the payment of the penalty of the law.
Yes.
By substituting, by making another die for you. And in this case, it was a sheep or a dove or whatever.
Right, right. Yes, exactly. Okay. So verse 10, which stood only in meats and drinks and diverse washings and carnal ordinances imposed on them until the time of Reformation. Okay, so obviously he's still talking about rituals. He's not talking about any of the commandments or the judgments that relate to the commandments. He's simply talking about these rituals.
The thing that confuses a lot of people today is you have rituals, you have law, statutes.
Yes.
And that's judgments. There are several different things, and the churches today have taken the ordinances, which were just rituals, and tried to say that's the law, and that's what was nailed to the cross, and it wasn't. It was only these rituals that was cast out.
Exactly.
And the Levitical priesthood.
Yes, yes. So, yeah, what we're talking about, we're never, and this is obviously a matter of interpretation by both the Universalists and the Antinomians, who believe that Paul is talking about the whole law. And in fact, I think in these two books that we've been discussing in great detail, Galatians and Hebrews, never does Paul talk about the whole law, at least in terms of it having to be abolished. He's only talking about abolishing these blood rituals. Isn't that correct?
Right, ordinances.
Yes. And that these ordinances are these things that these priests were doing for the propitiation, as you say, or for the redeeming of and paying the debt for various sins. And it never gets beyond that. And there's nothing Paul ever says beyond these ordinances. Okay, he never once says the whole law is to be abolished. Never.
Absolutely.
Go ahead.
I have a couple of points to make. That various cleansings is how I translate it.
Okay.
And that word is the Greek word baptismos, which is translated baptism elsewhere in the Bible.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Now, this time of Reformation, that word's not reformation.
Okay.
That word is diorthosis. And that is used, and it's defined by Liddell and Scott, in a physical sense, a making straight, a restoring of something to its natural and normal condition.
Okay.
It's a restoration.
Restoration, I was going to ask you about that. Yeah. Whether that was an accurate translation here.
Right. It's not the time of reformation. It's the time of restoration.
Yeah.
You can only restore something that you had in the first place.
Right. Okay.
It goes back to the fact that the covenants, the redemption, the sacrifice on the cross, it's all for Israel.
Exactly. Since only Israel was given the law, and since only Israel vowed not to break the law, and since Israel only broke the law, Israel is the one that needs to be restored, correct?
Absolutely.
Yeah. It doesn't.
And Israel is the only nation, even out of the Adamic nations, that Yahweh accepted his children in the first place.
That's right.
And that goes all the way back to Deuteronomy 14:1.
Right, right. So we are the leading tribes of the restoration. And, of course, this restoration will affect all Adamites because we are the called-out ones who are supposed to perform the law. Right? Yeah, Pastor Greg?
Supposed to.
Yes. and we, at least in this time within Christian identity, we're trying to obey the law, and I have to say that we are generating a tremendous interest in the Holy Scriptures, far greater interest than mainstream Christianity is generating. You know, so I think what we're doing here is starting to have an impact. You know, and that's really great to see. Okay. All right, verse 11. But Christ being come a high priest of good things to come by a greater and more perfect tabernacle, not made with hands, that is to say, not of this building. Okay, so we're not talking about churches made of brick and mortar and pews and stuff. Okay, verse 12. Okay, you have something to comment here, Bill?
No, that was Ken.
Okay, all right, okay, verse 12. Neither by the blood of goats, okay, we're talking about the blood rituals here, neither by the blood of goats and calves, but by his own blood, he entered in once into the holy place, having obtained eternal redemption for us, okay, for us, not for the whole world, okay, verse 13. For if the blood of bulls and of goats and the ashes of a heifer sprinkling the unclean sanctifies to the purifying of the flesh, how much more shall the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without spot to God, purge your conscience from dead works to serve the living God? Okay, so we're talking about here's the new covenant. Here's the establishment of the new covenant, the oblations and sacrifices. Paul is telling us here are no longer in effect. Of course, he quoted in chapter 8 that entire passage from Jeremiah 31, 31 through 37, which testifies of the new covenant. Okay? That's what Paul is talking about here. Isn't that correct, Pastor Greg?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Verse 15 actually kind of sums it up, too.
Okay. Well, before I get to that, let me, I have a question on this expression here, dead works. What does this say here, Bill? Is this a good translation?
Well, the word literally means works.
Okay.
But I translated dead rituals, and I do that because Paul is clearly talking here throughout the chapter about the Levitical ordinances
in
the rituals.
Yes.
In conducting the rituals of the temple for sin and repentance and conciliation. And that is the context.
Yeah.
That the word was used in the Septuagint in the book of Leviticus to describe those same rituals.
Yes.
The word ergon or works was used.
Okay.
The same Greek word.
Yes.
So it has to be in context translated dead rituals.
Yes. Yes. Now the word dead. Now, is are we talking about the fact that animals had to be killed in order for these rituals to take effect, or is there a broader
effect of the rituals are dead?
Yes,
the rituals themselves are dead.
Oh,
okay. They're gone. They're done with.
Yes, very good, very good. Okay, so verse 15, and for this cause he is the mediator of the New Testament, that by means of death for the redemption of the transgressions that were under the first testament, they which are called, underline, folks, they which are called, not the whole world, folks, might receive the promise of eternal inheritance. And so this goes into what we in identity, in our interpretation of the coming of the kingdom, is eternal life. In the flesh, okay? You don't have to die to go to heaven necessarily. In fact, those people who have died are waiting for the kingdom to come. It has not come yet. And so we're all, the living and the dead in Christ, are still waiting for this day. All right, so, yeah?
Let me read it in from the scripture here.
Okay.
It says, and because of this, he is the mediator of a renewed covenant. The only thing, He took that same covenant. He just took out these ritual ordinances and the Levitical priesthood, but he renewed the rest of that covenant.
Right.
So that's the only thing it really changed. It says so that death having taken place for redemption of the transgressions under the first covenant, those who are called might receive the promise of the everlasting inheritance.
Okay.
This is something that he promised, and he can't go back on.
Right.
And it's everlasting, and he never changed any word from his people to everybody.
Yeah. So in other words, everything, all the other promises are to be kept, because it's a covenant. Yahweh's covenant to his people, and he's not going to break his word. And the Old Testament clearly says that these sacrifices and rituals are to be done away with. They're temporary. And so that's what's promised, and so this is the fulfillment of that promise, but there's nothing else that's going to be done away with. Okay? Isn't that how you understand it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And what did he say? If you can break the covenant with the moon and stars?
Right.
Yeah. Then you can break this covenant.
Yeah. Okay, Bill, you had a comment?
I wanted, what Ken is saying is correct in spirit, and the translation that he has is certainly correct in spirit.
Okay.
But kahines is a simple Greek word that means new.
Okay.
I just have to throw that that caveat in.
Okay. And that's, you're talking in verse 15, that first phrase?
Right, concerning the covenant.
Yes.
There's no doubt that the covenant is a renewal of Yahweh's relationship with Israel.
Yes, okay.
That's the whole theme of the Bible.
Right, right. Yeah, and that's certainly the theme of the New Testament.
Right, but I just don't want anybody going out there and insisting to somebody that word means renew,
mm-hmm,
or renewed, and when you look it up in the lexicon, you're not going to find that meaning.
Right, I see. Okay. All right, verse 16, for where a testament is, there must also of necessity be the death of the testator. And so we're literally talking, in the case, what we're talking about is an inheritance ritual where, you know, if the three of us, let's say, are the children of a father, and the father dies, and he has a last will and testament, and he bequeaths his estate to us. That's what we're talking about here, isn't it?
Absolutely. And the word diatheke can mean a will, a testament,
okay,
a covenant, or simply a contract.
Yes.
But here Paul is defining the word to us, and he clearly is using it in the sense of a will, a bequeathment.
Yes. Exactly. Yes. Yes.
Yeah, mine shows covenant here, which... And that's what we're talking about.
That's right.
That's right. Same covenant.
Yes, yes. And so, you know, this is fascinating stuff because we have in the world today a movement called communism, which tries to deprive people of their rightful inheritance. This inheritance is Yahweh's will. This is the way Yahweh wants it done, at least with us Israelites. And here we have these international Jews that hire communists like Karl Marx and Lenin and the whole slew of them that are trying to do away with the tradition of inheritance. So, Pastor Greg, let me ask you, if you are the recipient of an inheritance and the will is made out to you and you're the recipient, you're the heir of the fortune that left to you by your father, do your next door neighbors have any claim to that inheritance?
If they kill me, they might get it.
Right.
See, that's what it says. The thief came to steal and to kill. They came to steal our inheritance and to kill our race. They
yes.
tried to kill us off through homosexuality, through race mixing, through abortion, and every vile thing they can think of
right.
to destroy our race and to steal what is our inheritance.
There's an interesting question in the chat room, Fist of Yahweh. So no matter how bad Israel becomes, the covenant will never be broken? Well, certainly not by Yahweh. You know, we made a promise way back, you know, right after the Ten Commandments were given to us that we would follow that law. Yahweh still expects us to follow that law. And, you know, if we're not, how should I put it, if we're not capable of accepting the inheritance, then we'll just squander it. Isn't that how you would see it, Pastor Greg?
Well, the thing is...
And we're squandering it now.
Yeah. The thing is, Yahweh said, although Israel was as the sand of the sea, only a remnant will be saved.
Yes.
There's going to be a remnant that's always keeping that law.
Right.
And following, you know, everything.
Yeah. Yeah,
now, so yes, that covenant's going to continue because there's always going to be a remnant.
Because as we look around in the Anglo-Saxon world, the vast majority of the Anglo-Saxon people are not obeying, they're not keeping their side of the bargain, are they?
Right.
They need to hear this message. Bill, any comments from you on that?
I interpret that Old Testament prophecy to mean that a remnant of the race of Israel will always be preserved,
okay,
so that our redemption can be effected.
Right, right. Okay. Yeah,
and
so
that's the context of the Old Testament.
Right, right. And, of course, that takes us all the way to Revelation chapters 21 and 22, in which it says that, you know, the kingdom will be given to those who call upon Yahweh's name and who obey his commandments, all right? We have to obey the commandments. And, so it's the remnant. That remnant is the ones, those of us who call upon his name and obey his commandments.
Right.
And the rest of the so-called Christian world aren't doing that. They simply aren't.
Exactly.
Okay. All right, verse 17. For a testament is of force after men are dead, otherwise it is of no strength at all while the testator lives. So, again, we're talking about a literal inheritance as we understand last will and testament. Okay? Can this be understood in any other way, Bill?
No, I translate the word that Ken's version reads as covenant. I translate that testament here so that we don't lose the connection between that and the verb testator.
Okay.
Which I can't translate that word any other way in this context.
Yeah.
Testator.
Yeah.
It is necessary to endure the death of the testator.
Yeah.
Paul is definitely showing that the new covenant is the will of Yahweh,
right,
and that it comes into effect with the death of Yahweh.
That's okay.
The death of Christ on the cross.
Exactly, exactly. And then certainly, and so this would be, how should I put it? Because what we have in terms of dispensationalism, we have in the Judeo-Christian world is teaching that somehow Israel is no longer, because they equate Israel with the Jews, which is false to begin with, that somehow now the covenant made with literal flesh Israel is done away with, and somehow their church organization, and here Paul is saying, I'm not talking about church, I'm not talking about brick-and-mortar churches, I'm talking about people. Isn't this what's going on here? We're talking about Israelites.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Every one of Paul's epistles proves that he's writing to Israelites.
Yes.
And there's no doubt. And I hope that here on the show we get to discuss every one of them.
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
And to elucidate that, because it's once you understand the language and see it, I mean, it's absolutely clear.
Right.
But it's so many words that are glazed over in the AV translation.
Yes.
That a lot of people can never see it because not everybody can pick up a concordance in the Bible and look up all these words, and it takes a lot of time.
Yeah, and certainly the Judeo-Christian Baal priests aren't doing it, are they? Yet they're giving these broad, generalized statements that the law has been done away with and that the covenants no longer apply to literal Israel, and the covenants have been given to somebody else entirely, when no will and testament works that way. Does it, Pastor Greg?
No.
No.
And here in Revelation 12:17, it says, and the dragon, which is Satan and his followers, was enraged with the woman, which is Israel.
Yeah.
And he went to fight with the remnant of her seed. Well, who are they fighting against? They ain't fighting against the Judeos out here in the church world today. Those guarding the commands of Yahweh and possessing the witness of Yahshua Messiah.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
That defines us, the Christian Israelite people. We're the only ones that pertains to.
Right.
Not the whole church world.
That's right. That's right. So no will. And at the reading of the will, no other entity besides the literal heirs can come to claim any inheritance, correct?
Right.
So how can these churches come in and say, oh, no, this doesn't apply to literal Israel anymore. We're claiming the inheritance. Aren't they simply arrogating unto themselves? Aren't they simply coming in? Aren't they party crashers or will crashers? There must be a term for this in the legal world. Somebody coming in and claiming somebody else's inheritance? Isn't that what they're doing?
Exactly.
I don't know if there is a term for a will crasher, but that's what they're doing.
Yeah. That is what they're doing. Exactly. Okay, verse 18. Whereupon neither the first testament was dedicated without blood, okay, because it was all had to do with blood and the blood rituals and sacrifices. Verse 19. For when Moses had spoken every precept to all the people according to the law, he took the blood of calves and of goats with water and scarlet wool and hyssop and sprinkled both the book and all the people. Okay, so these blood rituals were commanded, but we're also told that they were temporary. Okay? Verse 20, saying, this is the blood of the testament which God has enjoined to you. Moreover, and this language is very similar to the Last Supper language that Yahshua Messiah uses. Verse 21, moreover, he sprinkled with blood both the tabernacle and all the vessels of the ministry, and almost all things are by the law purged with blood, and without shedding of blood there is no remission or forgiveness. Verse 23, it was therefore necessary that the patterns of things in the heavens should be purified with these, but the heavenly things themselves with better sacrifices than these. What's this verse 23 here saying, Bill?
Well, first, where it says that this is the blood of the covenant which Yahweh has enjoined to you.
Yes.
That's a quote. I just thought I'd notice that. That's a quote of Exodus 24:8.
Okay.
It's straight from Exodus 24:8.
Right. Okay. Yeah, so, yeah, and Paul is constantly quoting the Old Testament, and some people think he's quoting it incorrectly, which I find is never the case. He's always quoting it correctly. Okay.
Now, I have verse 23, so it is a necessity indeed for these patterns, for the things in the heavens to be purified by these means, but the heavenly things themselves with better sacrifices than these. He's saying that all the temple rituals, everything done in the tabernacle in the wilderness and in the temple of Solomon, they were all simply patterns that were models for the future.
Okay.
They weren't the permanent model that we were to live by, which is the Hebrews, they didn't want to part with their ways. They didn't want to change their tradition.
Yeah.
They did not want to give up the things they've been doing for 1,500 years.
Right, right. Okay. All right. And obviously, when the Israelites came out of Egypt, they didn't want to leave Egypt either. They had become comfortable as slaves, didn't they?
Right.
Okay, we're getting some interference. Who's WRON?
Oh, that's me. You go ahead and mute me.
Yeah, I'm going to have to mute you because there's all of a sudden noise here, okay? Sorry. All right, so verse 24. Because, before we go to verse 24, we tend to get comfortable in our enslavement, okay? And what's really going on is we get comfortable in our daily routine, but it's not providing liberty. And we get comfortable as slaves, and Yahweh wants us to be free. Isn't that the case?
Yes.
Yeah. And so
we're absolutely resistant to change.
That's right. That's right. And so Yahweh is doing all this stuff. He's breaking down our structures so that we will eventually be free, whether we like it or not. Okay. All right. Verse 24. For Christ is not entered into the holy places made with hands, which are the figures of the true, but into heaven itself, now to appear in the presence of God for us. Verse 25, nor yet he should offer himself often, as the high priest enters into the holy place every year with the blood of others. Now, to me, this verse 25 is a challenge to the Catholic teaching, you know, in which they say that what they call transubstantiation, that the Catholic priest every Sunday literally offers the blood as the a flesh of Jesus Christ. But here Paul is saying, no, this is only one time. shouldn't the Catholics be looking at this verse and taking this seriously?
Well, they'll never understand that the body and blood of Christ are the people that were sitting around a table partaking with.
Right.
They'll never understand that. They can't.
Okay.
If you're not his kin, you can't share in that body or blood.
Right, right. Yeah, and of course, in other passages, Paul clearly says that we are the literal body of Christ.
Right, all the time.
Yeah, yeah. It's not that wafer.
No, Paul's
it's not that wafer that the Catholic priest is holding up.
Paul explained what happened the night of the Last Supper, and he goes through that in Corinthians.
Okay.
But his model for communion is not that. That's not what he practiced.
Right.
So that explanation must mean something else.
Yes.
And
yes.
It does. what he practiced was simply taking the bread on the boat, for instance, in Acts chapter 27, giving thanks to Yahweh, breaking it, and sharing it with his
right.
with people.
And that's communion with your brethren.
Right. That's
yes.
what communion really is.
Yeah. Okay, Ken, you had something to say here?
If you
lost your, I can come back to you if you're looking for a verse.
I don't know what I was going to say.
Okay. All right. Okay, let me just continue because there's only three more verses in chapter 9. For then must he often have suffered since the foundation of the world. So, you know, of course, if transubstantiation is true, he'd be suffering every Sunday. But he's saying here, no, he only suffered once. But now, once in the end of the world, he has appeared to put away sin by the sacrifice of himself. And that's how we understand it. It was a one-time only sacrifice. He's not going to do it again, folks. Verse 27. And as it is appointed to men once to die, but after this is the judgment. And, you know, it amazes me that another universalistic teaching is that all of us are going to be saved. But that makes a mockery of judgment. Doesn't Jesus Christ clearly say that when he comes again, he is going to kick booty? And all the evil people in the world are going to be, as in the parable of the wheat and tares, are going to be bundled and burned.
Yeah. Well, we have the parable in Matthew 25 of the goat and the sheep.
Uh-huh.
And that basically means that the sheep are nations which, for the most part, abide by his law.
Right.
And the goats are nations that never abode by his law.
Right, right.
And the goats are nations.
Yes.
And they go into the fire.
That's right.
They're done. The sheep go into the kingdom.
Yeah, so that doesn't sound like he loves everybody.
No, and here in verse 28 it says, so also Christ has been offered once to make contribution for the errors of many.
Yes.
Not of all.
Right.
Of many.
Yes. That's verse 28, yeah. Pastor Greg, you had something to comment on here?
Yeah, talking about the judgment in Isaiah 6:15. For look, Yahweh comes with fire and with his chariots with like a whirlwind to render his displeasure with burning and his rebuke with flames of fire.
Mm-hmm.
Fire, and by his sword Yahweh shall judge all flesh, and the slain of Yahweh shall be many. And, you know, it talks about two-thirds of people are going to die.
Right.
There's going to be a lot of Israelites in this. Now, you know, the scripture says that all Israel will be saved, but it also talks about that the alien will prune our vineyards and the stranger will till our ground.
Yes, yes.
That word stranger there is actually comes out as Adamic.
Okay.
And,
all right.
So what kind of position will they have in the kingdom?
Right. Well, first of all, that expression, all Israel, I'm not sure if that means every single Israelite will be saved, because it means, how should I put it, those Israelites who are not obeying the law are going to be bundled and burned with the tares. I think what that expression, all Israel, means is that members of all 12 tribes, okay, because the Old Testament expression, all Israel, meant all 12 tribes, and then you have the house of Judah meant the two plus some Levites, and then house of Israel meant the other 10 plus some Levites. Okay, how do you see that, Bill?
Well, I take Paul's statement that all Israel shall be saved more or less at face value, and
okay.
I have reasons for that. First, we all have the spirit that Yahweh gave to Adam.
Okay.
And I don't think that it's a mistake that the Greek word for inconquerable or undestroyable is adamas or adamant.
Right. Okay.
I think that's an indication of the fact that the Adamic spirit cannot be destroyed.
Okay.
It belongs to Yahweh. It is part of Yahweh. And
okay.
He has given it to us, and we formulate our own personality and being. But we are part of him, and that can't be destroyed.
Right, right.
So,
okay, go ahead.
The promise to Abraham that his seed would exceed the stars and the sand of the sea in multitude. If you eliminate all the sinners from that, you might have a bucket of sand.
Yeah, right. A few dominoes.
Yeah.
So one of the other potential interpretations is... Hello?
It's got to have another meaning because, you know, he also said there's none perfect, no, not one.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we all sin in some way or another.
Yes.
And, and it says, what, if you do one, you've broken them all.
Right, right.
Absolutely. That's in James. He who has broken one law is responsible, is liable to the whole law.
Right, right. So if we take that expression, all Israel will be saved, certainly it's possible after the judgment day, those Israelites who fail to observe the law and call upon his name will be bundled and burned along with the tares, but the Bible also talks about a future resurrection, which might occur after the judgment day, and they'll be given some time to think about how they've erred.
Well, that's true. We are judged. The trial by fire is here in this life now.
Yes, yes.
If you're going to be disobedient, your punishment will be brought to fruit in this life.
Yes.
And it may be immediate or it may be a long ways off, but it's going to happen. There's no doubt.
That's right. That's right.
However, Yahshua Christ went during those 3 days that he was in the earth, he went and spoke to the spirits in prison.
Right.
And that means that he went to hell.
Yes.
And preached to those Israelites who had died.
Yes.
And were in that prison. And there's a metaphysical explanation as to what all that means. And we're going to see some of that right here coming up in Hebrews chapter 10.
Okay.
Where Paul says that we gain access to Yahweh. Basically, he's saying that we gain access to Yahweh on a physical plane. We have that access only because of Christ's sacrifice.
Okay.
And that we're separated from mm-hmm. Yahweh after we die until the sacrifice of Christ.
Right. Yeah, so let's take this back then to Genesis 3:15, where Adam and Eve sinned and fell. Aren't we talking about the restoration of the Holy Spirit that Yahweh is the breath of life that Yahweh breathed into our people? That without Yahshua's sacrifice on the cross, this could not be accomplished.
Right, and it goes back to the idea of Satan, of the original rebel angels.
Yes.
Being the Diabolos, which means the false accuser.
Right.
Called in the Revelation, the accuser of our brethren is cast down.
Yes. Yes.
Satan, because Adam failed, the Satan has an accusation against our entire race.
Yes, okay.
And it came out in the story of Job and in other stories in the Bible. And it's part of a bigger spiritual picture that we aren't shown the entire picture in the Bible.
Right, yeah. And that's
not all revealed to us, but it's absolutely there. It's definitely there.
Yeah.
It's there in the story, and it's there in the meanings of the words.
Yes, yeah. Pastor Greg, you had a comment on that?
No.
Okay, but obviously this is what faith is all about, isn't it? That we, certainly we can't understand everything that's going on here. We have a pretty good understanding of what's going on. And the rest of it, we just have to turn over to faith.
Right. Now, I hate to get ahead of you, but that verse I was referencing in chapter 10 that we're about to come to is verse 19.
Okay.
Therefore, brethren, having liberty into the entrance of the holy places in the blood of Yahshua.
Okay.
Now, in the temple model, only the high priest could go into the Holy of Holies.
Right.
At designated times.
Yes, yes. And so Yahshua, by his death on the cross, has made that available to all of us because we're supposed to become a kingdom of priests.
Absolutely.
Okay.
The temple was a model for the spiritual future that we have, and he opened the way for us in that restoration that he effected for us.
Right, right. Okay, so there's one more verse in chapter 9. So Christ was once offered again. This is about the third time he says once, only one time. So Christ was once offered to bear the sins of many, not all, And to them that look for him shall appear, he appear the second time without sin to salvation. So at the second coming, this is when all of this, his personal sacrifice, is going to bear fruit. Okay? And again, it's an exclusivist message because it says many. It doesn't say all. All right, chapter 10. For the law having a shadow of good things to come and not the very image of the things can never with those sacrifices, he's talking about sacrifices, not talking about the whole law here, which they offered year by year continually make the comers thereunto perfect. In other words, you cannot perfect people by offering sacrifices. Isn't this what he's saying?
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. And so in the Old Testament, Yahweh says, I hate your rituals. I prefer obedience. Okay? He wants us to obey.
Right.
And the way that obedience is accomplished is by writing the law in our hearts.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you can say you love me all day long. Your performance.
I love you, Ken.
I mean, you know, your performance shows whether you love me or not.
That's right. That's right.
And
okay.
And to continually go out and do things and have to continually offer dead animals.
Yes.
What good is that? But,
yeah, and plus, as long as we're offering dead animals, that means that we're still sinning, doesn't it? We're not performing like we're supposed to.
Right. It's like I said before, you know, that's why people love the Catholic religion. You know, you go out and do whatever you want all week and go down on,
right.
You know, say a few Hail Marys or whatever they do.
That's right.
Light a candle.
Right.
Light a candle, put some money in a box, say 10 Hail Marys. And,
yeah, exactly. And then afterwards you can go out and have a beer with the priest.
Go do the same thing all over again.
Right, exactly. Exactly.
Exactly. It's the perfect religion. And really, the church world today, the Baptists and all the rest of them are the same thing because they're teaching that we're not under any law.
Right.
If you're not under any law, you cannot sin.
That's right. But Paul is not saying absolutely nothing like this.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean,
that was saved, always saved theology and the Catholic theology of penance is going to come apart when we hit Hebrews 10:26.
Right. Okay. Well, let's continue. Okay, verse 2. For then would they not have ceased to be offered? Yeah, I mean, what we were just saying, though, if they had stopped sinning, then they wouldn't have them be offering these sacrifices. Because,
right, or if sacrifices actually did take away the sin.
Right, right.
In reality, rather than just be a symbol of that.
Exactly, exactly. But obviously the fact that you're still having to offer sacrifices means you're not living up to your bargain. Because that the worshippers once purged should have had no more conscience of sins or awareness of sins, okay? So it's much better, you know, to be cleansed in our minds than to have to be cleansed by sacrifices after the fact, after committing sins. Verse 3. But in those sacrifices there is a remembrance again made of sins every year, of course. So we want to forget that, right? Don't we want to put that behind us? Verse 4. For it is not possible that the blood of bulls and of goats should take away sins, okay? Now, this is in the present tense. So, Bill, he's not saying that it wasn't possible, but isn't he saying that Yahweh made it acceptable temporarily?
Yes, that's why it's called. That's why he calls it conciliation.
Okay.
The mercy seat is called the seat of conciliation. In reality, that's what it meant.
Yes, okay.
And here he's saying, for it is impossible for the blood of bulls and goats to take away errors.
Right.
That's just it. In other words, it never really happened in the first place.
That's
it was
right.
Only a temporary patch-up between Yahweh and Israel.
Exactly. Exactly. All right. Verse 5. Wherefore, when he comes into the world, he says, "Sacrifice and offering you would not, but a body have you prepared me. In burnt offerings and sacrifices for sin you have had no pleasure." And he's talking about Yahweh here. Okay. Yahweh says this much in Isaiah, verse 7. Then said I, lo, I come in the volume of the book it is written of me to do your will, O God. Okay, that's what we're here for, to do his will. Verse 8. above when he said, sacrifice and offering and burnt offerings and offering for sin you would not, neither had pleasure therein, which are offered by the law. This is kind of confusing language here in the King James. Bill, you want to clarify?
Then I said, behold, in a chapter of the book it is written concerning me that I will do, O Yahweh, your will.
Okay.
Staying above sacrifices and offerings, and burnt offerings also for errors you have not desired, nor have you been pleased with,
mm-hmm.
which are offered in accordance with the law.
Okay.
In other words, Paul's saying that the scripture, the Old Testament, says that even
yes.
though those sacrifices are offered in accordance with the law, they did not truly please Yahweh.
Right.
They were only a temporary conciliation.
Very good.
Then
Very
he
good.
Said, behold, I come that I will do your will.
Mm-hmm.
That's what pleases Yahweh, the
right.
doing of his will.
Exactly, exactly. And then to finish verse 9, he takes away the first that he may establish the second. So in other words, he takes away the sacrifices and oblations, Daniel 9:27, that he may establish the second, Jeremiah 31:31-37.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And so, you know, these universalists cannot connect the dots between Hebrews 10:9 and Daniel 9:27 Jeremiah 31. What's
well,
wrong with these people?
They threw out. They dispensed. They're dispensationalism.
Right.
Dispensed of the Old Testament.
They've dispensed with the Old Testament, exactly.
And hasn't
Testament. Right. But in dispensing with the Old Testament, haven't they dispensed with Yahweh?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Man can't change the words of God and pick and choose what he wants.
Right.
That's just not possible. That's absolutely arrogant to imagine that anybody could do that.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, so those people who think they can change Yahweh's mind.
They're self-righteous people.
That's
exactly
right.
Well, it's not for them. He said, blessed are your eyes because they see and your ears because they hear.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone has eyes or ears.
Yes. Yes. Well, hopefully we can reach some more Israelites and open their eyes and ears. Okay, here we go, verse 10. By the which will we are sanctified through the offering of the body of Jesus Christ once for all. This is the fourth time that Paul says once. Once and only once is this sacrifice applicable. Verse 11. And every priest stands daily ministering and offering oftentimes the same sacrifices which can never take away sins. Okay, so he's repeating what he said now in verses 7 and 8, emphasizing the point. Again, it's in present tense. So, Bill, let me ask you, isn't it true that these sacrifices were still taking place even in Paul's time?
Yeah, they were probably taking place for hundreds of years after Paul's time in certain areas amongst dispensed Israelites.
Right, right. So so here he's obviously talking to these Judeans of the circumcision who have grown up and have centuries of tradition of offering sacrifices for their sins. And now Paul is telling these people, sorry, that's not working anymore.
Right. And for every pocket of true Judeans in the world, because there were quite a few, they were pretty much spread out. The Judean people, and by when I say Judean, I mean the descendants of the 40,000 who returned to Jerusalem.
Okay.
They had over 500 years between the time that the temple was rebuilt in 516 BC and 560-something years later until the time Paul writes this letter, they'd spread out throughout the whole world. They didn't stay in Jerusalem.
Right.
They
right.
were found in every major Roman city. They were spread all the way to Persia, throughout Mesopotamia. They had synagogues all over the place, and a lot of them were true Judah and Benjamin.
Right.
Even though a lot of them were Esau, too.
Yeah.
And for the word that Paul writes here to spread, and the gospel accounts to spread to all of those places in the ancient world, probably took many decades.
Yes. Yes. Okay.
For everybody to get a thorough account.
Sure, certainly, certainly. And so, and it gets back to the dispute that Peter and Paul had, that you know, that Paul's ministry is not to non-Israelites. Paul's ministry is to the dispersed Israelites, and many of those are, in fact, Judahites of the house of Judah, correct?
Oh, yes. There's many more Judahites of the house of Judah that are with the ten tribes. You see, a lot of people that learn identity through I learned it on my own.
Yes.
I mean, I read a lot of Swift and a lot of Comparé, but I sat with a whole pile of history books, and I wanted to learn everything they thought they knew firsthand.
Yeah.
And verify it all for myself.
Right.
And so I've never really had the ten-tribe, two-tribe mentality.
Okay.
And I could see how somebody gets stuck in that model.
Right.
But there
right.
were more Judahites with the ten tribes than there were left behind.
Right.
Except that they continued, the ones left behind continued to recall, to call themselves the two tribes.
Right.
And call the northern nation of Israel the ten tribes.
Yes.
That's their terminology to show that the people left behind were basically only consisted of Judah and Benjamin,
exactly,
with the apportionment of the Levites. But the Assyrians took everybody out except the inhabitants of Jerusalem.
Right.
Scripture makes that very clear. And the Assyrian inscriptions left behind by Sennacherib and his successors make that very clear.
Right, right.
He left Hezekiah locked up in Jerusalem like a canary in a cage.
Mm-hmm.
Is the term that he used.
Yeah.
And all the fenced cities, and certainly all the villages, if they took all the fenced cities, all those Judahites and Benjaminites were deported.
Yes.
So
okay.
That's like coming into New York. I mean, I'm upstate. There's 16 million people in this state. 8 million of them are in the city.
Right.
And
yes.
Take the city and, oh, we took all of New York. Yeah, all of New York City.
Right, right. Yeah. So, It's very important for people to understand that there were many Judahites and Benjamites
right.
that spread out throughout the entire dispersion. They weren't confined to Judea and Galilee.
Absolutely. The Judeans, they don't represent Judah by any means. They only represent 1% maybe
mm-hmm.
of Judah.
Okay.
50% going off at least with the Assyrians. And
yes.
Jerusalem was a large city. I mean, it may have held up to 4 million people at times,
mm-hmm.
and that's a lot. And
yes.
That can be pretty much established. Josephus says that 1.1 million Judeans, mostly Edomites,
yes.
were destroyed in the four-year war with Vespasian and Titus, with
right.
the Romans.
Right, right. Okay.
66 to 70 A.D.
Yes.
And if 1.1 million were destroyed, how many were involved?
Yeah.
And most
yeah.
of those people died in the siege of Jerusalem.
Right. And then during that siege, there was a hiatus, I forget how long, may have only been one day, in which many Christians were able to escape.
That hiatus was at least a year. I've written on that.
Oh, okay.
There was a particular general that had Jerusalem surrounded, and this proves the veracity of Luke, because Matthew and Mark do not word it in this way.
Okay.
And Yahshua Christ says, when you see Judea encircled or encompassed by armies. And then he's telling you that that's the sign to flee.
Right.
Well, what happened was a certain general, I think, I could be wrong, but I think his name is Cestius. I could look it up. The whole story's told in Josephus, by the way.
Okay.
Had Jerusalem conquered and was within a couple of days of forcing the city to surrender.
Yes.
And for no explained reason, he lifted the siege and took off for Damascus, for Syria.
Okay.
And there's no explained reason in history why he may have done that.
Okay. Well, the report I'm familiar with says that the reigning Caesar had died, and he was waiting for word whether to continue on the present path. He wasn't sure whether the new Caesar wanted to do the same thing. That's
well,
my understanding. I might be wrong.
That might be true, but that's not what I've read in the histories.
Okay. Okay.
And you are right that there was a series at that time of replacements of Caesar. Nero died, and then we had what happened
yes.
is we had the year of four emperors.
Right.
It was actually first it was Nero, and then it was in very fast succession, Galba, Otho, and Vitellius. But that didn't happen for a little while yet. That didn't happen until Vespasian had Jerusalem surrounded again and left Titus to the war so that he could go be the emperor,
right.
He went and removed Vitellius.
Okay. But this period, you say, was almost a year long, which enabled the Christian Judahites who had recognized and accepted Jesus Christ for that would allow them to get away.
Right, and we have the testimony of Eusebius and other early Christians that the Christians in Jerusalem took advantage of that first Roman general's raising of the siege.
Yes.
Get out.
Yes.
Which means that Luke, the prophecy as it appears in Luke, is fulfilled to the letter.
Uh-huh.
And shortly thereafter, Titus came and besieged the city and destroyed it, and most of the inhabitants were killed. Not all of them, but
right.
a great number of them.
And certainly no Jew would listen to Jesus when he tells them, when you see the encompassing armies, get out of here.
Oh, absolutely. Josephus only says that the noble people in the city fled.
Ah.
But it's obvious that they would have had the warnings of Christ.
That's right, because
and
the Jews aren't the noble people. Right. Okay.
Why did those Israelites get destroyed?
Well, there certainly were some, because some of them were fooled by the Edomites.
Well, I'm sure, but the Christians, for the most part, had the warnings of Christ, and they must have been amongst the number that fled.
Yes, oh, for sure.
It only makes sense, but it's an obvious pattern in history, if you want me to put it that way.
Well, yeah, it's playing out again right now.
Yeah, I mean,
the Edomites thought they could get the upper hand over the Romans. A lot of them were robbing each other and raping and looting and pillaging each other, taking advantage of the situation.
Right.
Just like the lights go out in New York and everybody's hitting the stores.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, we start acting like the non-Israelites, yes.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right, let's continue here. Verse 12. But this man, after he had offered one sacrifice for sins forever, sat down on the right hand of God. Verse 13. From hereafter, expecting till his enemies be made his footstool. And this is going to be total victory, folks. That's what this means. Verse 14. For by one offering, this is about the seventh or eighth time that Paul has stressed this one offering, he has perfected forever them that are sanctified. Okay. That can't be everybody. Only a few have been sanctified, not everybody.
He is perfected for perpetuity, those being sanctified. And that has to mean those same people that were offering those other sin offerings.
Yes.
It can't be a different party.
Yes.
It has to be the same party of the Old Testament sacrifices.
Right.
And that can only mean Israel.
Well, the very word holy, as used in the Old Testament, means called out ones, separated ones, people selected for this particular purpose.
Well, the word hagios is translated is the word most often behind the word holy when we see it.
Okay.
And the Greek word hagios specifically means devoted, set aside and devoted to the purposes of a god.
Right. Right.
And it's a word used in the Greek pagan
right.
world also, because it's a secular Greek word.
Right, right.
And the only people that were ever devoted to the purposes of Yahweh were the people in the loins of Isaac when he was placed on the altar
uh-huh.
with Abraham.
Right.
Period.
Yes.
The only people that could ever, ever be considered holy in the Hebrew Bible context of the word are the people placed that Yahweh took on that altar. They became his.
Yes.
All the descendants of Isaac became Yahweh's property, because that's what the word means.
Mm-hmm.
When you place something on a pagan altar and you dedicate it to that god, it becomes the property of that god.
Right.
And that's the whole religious context of the ancient world. All the religions of the ancient world, pagan religions,
yes.
and the Hebrew religion, had that belief.
Yeah, they dedicated themselves to that god, yeah.
And the only man ever placed on an altar and dedicated to God,
Yahweh, yes.
was Isaac.
Yes.
And the people in his loins were Jacob and Esau.
Right.
And Paul tells us in Romans chapter 9, Paul explains this whole thing, this whole scenario, and tells us that the children of Jacob are the vessels of mercy.
Yes.
Well, the children of Esau are also, quote-unquote, holy. They were also in Isaac's loins, but they're the vessels of destruction.
That's right.
And that's why the focus of who the enemy was when Esau married into the Canaanites and actually became the prominent tribe of Canaanites were the Edomites.
Yes.
He became the focal point for Yahweh's wrath.
Exactly. That's why Yahweh says, Esau have I hated.
Right. And Esau, his descendants are the vessels of destruction.
That's right.
Paul mentions in Romans 9.
Absolutely.
And that whole little bit of word meaning and biblical history is something that the mainstream churches could never, ever admit.
No, of course
not.
Because
it shows that the whole context of the Bible is centered around this one group of people. That nobody else, nobody that descended from anyone but Isaac could ever claim any part in this.
Right, right. And then in the book of Galatians, we ran across the same thing where Paul was talking about the descendants of Isaac versus descendants of Ishmael. The Ishmaelites did not count either. As
absolutely
chosen.
Not.
Yes.
And Paul is making a clear distinction between the seeds of the descendants of Abraham.
That's right.
The word is plural, and he's using a collective noun in the plural to make his point that there's different sets of seed here.
Yeah, that's right.
And he's saying that only this one seed, meaning not the Christ, not Yahshua Christ in the person is one seed. He's not the recipient of the promises of his own covenant.
Mm-hmm.
It should say the anointed as a group, Genesis 3:16.
Yes.
The anointed as a group are the chosen seed,
or Galatians 3:16,
descendants of Jacob.
Right, right.
And Paul tells the Galatians in chapter 4, and we, brethren, and I know the King James says according to, but the word kata in its most literal term means down through.
Okay.
And we, brethren, down through Isaac are the children of the promise.
Yes. Or descended from Isaac.
Right, absolutely.
Yes.
That's what he means.
Yes, yes. Okay. So all of this language is very exclusivistic. I have not detected one word of universalism. Obviously, there was some in Galatians because there were very bad translations in there, and the word anointed is one of those bad translations because it does not always refer to the individual Christ. Sometimes it refers to our seed, okay? And I can understand how people get confused on that point. But we've covered nearly 10 full chapters of Hebrews, and I have not detected a single universalist word in the book of Hebrews.
No, the true language in Paul is all exclusivist.
Yes.
And even where Paul says all men, if you go to Romans chapter 5 and read I think it's from verses 12 through 21 of Romans chapter 5. Paul defines the word man as a descendant of Adam.
Okay, right.
So when you read that, wherever you see the word anthropos or man in one of Paul's letters, you have to define that by going back to Romans chapter 5.
Okay.
And seeing that Paul means Adam, through one man, Adam. Sin came into the society.
Right.
That word world is should be society where almost wherever it is.
Okay.
And I can demonstrate fully that the word cosmos means society. It doesn't mean the world.
Right. Okay.
Actually, the verb cosmos is a decoration.
Yes.
And the Greeks had two words that the King James translated, actually three words, but two of them matter here. They translate world, and they're oikoumene and cosmos.
Mm-hmm.
The oikoumene is the physical plant that we live on, the part of the earth that we live on,
okay,
is the oikoumene. And the cosmos is the decoration of the oikoumene.
Yes.
It's the arrangement or the order of things in the oikoumene. The cosmos is the society. That's the only way we could translate it in English.
Right, right. Okay. Any thoughts from you, Pastor Greg?
And that word man, too, you know, I know one connotation there is male-female.
Okay.
And because, you know, it used to puzzle me why there's a woman sitting on the throne, because the promise was there shall not cease to be a man
mm-hmm.
on the throne. But that word man is connotation male-female.
Well,
yeah.
It's a descendant of Adam.
Adamite. It means Adamite, yes. Yes, exactly. Okay. Yeah.
It's not in the translations here.
Right. Right. But certainly it's part of Yahweh's law that whenever there is not a male heir in the seed line, then the female that takes the place until another male heir appears. Okay?
Yes.
And so that's why Queen Elizabeth is sitting on the throne right now. Okay? All right, verse 15. Whereof the Holy Ghost also is a witness to us, for after that he had said before, quote, this is the covenant that I will make with them, and he's quoting Jeremiah 31 again, that I will make with them after those days, says Yahweh, I will put my laws into their hearts, and in their minds will I write them. He does not say I will do away with these laws. It's incredible how they can teach this. Verse 1, go ahead.
And two, this is a covenant that I shall make with them. Well, who did he make the covenant with?
Right.
It was Israel. Nobody else.
Yeah. And if there is such a thing as spiritual Israel, Pastor Greg, they are not party to the covenant because they're not keeping the law in their hearts, are they?
And that's what I call one of them spiritual lies.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
It's a spiritual lie. There's no doubt about it. Yes. Okay. And verse 17, and their sins and iniquities will I remember no more. Of course, he's talking exclusively to the Israelites here. Verse 18, now where remission of these is, there is no more offering for sin. Now this would be the bottom line, wouldn't it, Bill? That, you know, I mean, no more, you know, we're done with these sacrifices. It's over.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Just like Daniel said it would be.
Yes. Okay, verse 19, having therefore, brethren, boldness to enter into the holiest by the blood of Jesus, by a new and living way, of course, in our hearts, as opposed to on a sacrificial altar, which he has consecrated for us through the veil, that is to say, his flesh, and of course, our flesh.
Yeah.
I mean, where does the Holy Spirit reside?
In the flesh, in the body is a vessel for the flesh.
In our flesh.
Here, Paul's saying a couple of, this is where I was discussing before, therefore, brethren, having liberty into the entrance of the holy places.
Okay.
In the blood of Yahshua. In other words, we in the spirit can approach Yahweh.
Yes.
Because we, Israel, had become odious to Yahweh.
Right.
Okay. And there's a whole metaphysical thing I could get into here about Yahshua being Yahweh and all that that I'll skip over. But Yahweh had to die in the flesh to become reconciled to Israel.
Okay.
Because when a wife, and Paul explains this in Romans chapter 7 in detail.
Okay.
When a wife cheats on her husband, by the law in Deuteronomy, the husband cannot take her back.
Uh-huh. Right.
But if he dies, the wife can come back.
Right. Right.
To the risen Christ.
Yeah.
That's the whole key to understanding the Bible and the marriage relationship between Israel and Yahweh.
And so it's just the promise of the reconciliation.
Absolutely. But he had to die to effect the reconciliation to fulfill the law.
Right.
That's why Christ says, I came to fulfill the law. And it's all wrapped up in that marriage relationship. And I could walk through the New Testament and expound on this.
Sure.
And I have a paper on my website called The Divorce Discourse.
Okay.
Which goes into this in depth. And that's why Christ fulfilled the law.
But this in part answers the question because Rebel Pride had a question. If we don't love Yahweh, are we as bad as Esau? Well, no, we're just misguided Israelites, right?
Well, yeah, that's true. We're misguided Israelites because he went to the – would you imagine when Yahshua Christ, as Peter explains, preached to the spirits in prison,
yes,
that any of them disbelieved at that point?
Yeah, right. Unless there's Jews down there.
Right, but there's definitely no Jews down there.
Okay. All right, verse 21. and having a high priest over the house of God, okay, which is Yahshua Messiah. Verse 22, let us draw near with a true heart and full assurance of faith, having our hearts sprinkled from an evil consciousness and our bodies washed with pure water. Okay, it's kind of, again, confusing language, having our hearts sprinkled from an evil conscience, awkward sentence. But I think what he's trying to say, the evil has been sprinkled out of us, right? Isn't that what he's trying to say here?
We should approach with a true heart, in certainty of faith, having purified the hearts from a wicked conscience.
Okay.
And having washed the body in pure water. And that's a metaphor.
Yes.
That's a metaphor. If you go to Ephesians 5:22, he talks about Christ's relationship with the assembly, and Paul says, in order that he would consecrate it, meaning the assembly, cleansing it in the bath of the water of the word, or in the word.
Yes.
In 1 Peter 3:21, Peter says, which also now a representation saves you, immersion, meaning baptism.
Yes.
Not a putting away of the filth of the flesh, but a demand of a good conscience towards Yahweh through a resurrection of Yahshua Christ,
yes,
who is walking in heaven at the right hand of Yahweh, messengers and authorities and powers being made subject to him. We could see that the language that Peter uses, not a putting away of the filth of the flesh, is the same language that Paul's using here in Hebrews.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. And when Peter and Paul were reconciled about the circumcision business, there's from that point on, there was no more conflict between the two, not that I'm aware of. Okay.
Right. And the amazing part is here that Peter's writing to Gentiles and Paul's writing to...
Right. Exactly. They're writing to their opposite, contingencies.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah, okay.
And my point here was to show that this pure water, this true water, is the Word.
Yes.
It's the cleansing in the bath of the water of the Word, as Paul says in Ephesians 5:22.
Yeah. Okay, so in verse 23 then, let us hold fast the profession of our faith, not anybody's faith, not just any old faith, our faith. And, of course, we're talking right from, you know, people are still steeped in the Old Testament here. You know, the New Testament hasn't been written yet.
That's true. What you're saying is true in the Codex Ephraimi Sinai,
okay,
has our faith, but all the other codices have the faith.
Okay.
I just had to throw that up there because not too many translations are going to have our faith.
I see.
And mine doesn't, because of the preponderance of the evidence lies with all the other manuscripts.
Right. But even with the article, the definite article, the, that makes
the
it very
faith.
Specific,
it's
not any old faith, but the faith of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob.
Yes, the faith of the Old Testament.
That's
it's all
right.
The same faith. Christianity is the same faith that the Hebrew forefathers had.
Yeah, minus
and
the sacrifices.
Christianity, Hebrewism is Christianity before Christ.
That's right. Pastor Greg?
Right. Let me back up on 22 here.
Okay.
Let us draw near with a true heart and completeness of belief.
Okay.
What he's talking about here is that law, you know, completeness. You know, completely following the word, the law, the commandments, the judgments, the statutes,
yes,
the feast days, the Sabbath, all these things is what he's talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Having our hearts sprinkled from a wicked conscience and our bodies washed with clean water. In other words, we don't have to worry about doing, a conscious boldness of what things that we have been doing,
mm-hmm,
that we should be completely into the belief, and you're going to show that by your works, your walks.
Yeah,
you know.
absolutely. And we were talking about earlier, we have to demonstrate, if you want to prove that you love somebody, you have to demonstrate it, not just talk the talk. You have to walk the walk.
Right.
There's just no way around that. Okay, and Jesus said, if you love me, obey my commandments.
Right.
He didn't say sit on your butt waiting to be raptured. Okay. Verse 24, and let us consider one another to provoke to love, and speaking of love, and to what? Good works? Paul actually tells us to do good works? Isn't Isn't this the opposite of what the universalists are telling us?
Yeah, I have, and we should consider one another in regard to stimulation of love and of good deeds.
Okay. Now, aren't they always telling us, aren't these universalists always telling us that works mean nothing?
Right. Well, works mean everything because they're the expression of your faith and your love for your brethren.
That's right. And that's exactly what James is trying to tell us, too. Because how do you put it? Faith without works is dead.
Right.
Okay. Verse 25. Not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together, as the manner of some is, but exhorting one another, and so much the more as you see the day approaching. So, first of all, because there are some people who think that and it's kind of ironic, that the Sabbaths, some people think that the Sabbaths, we no longer have to keep the Sabbaths. But isn't he saying here, no, we should keep the Sabbaths, but in addition to that, we should start exhorting one another. We should start telling each other, pleading with each other to be better Christians.
Yeah.
Okay? There's nothing. We're still obligated to observe the feast days and the Sabbaths. Okay?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Verse 26. For if we sin willfully. Now, this is to those people who say once saved, always saved. For if we sin willfully, after that we have received the knowledge of the truth, there remains no more sacrifice for sins, but a certain fearful looking for of judgment and fiery indignation, which shall devour the adversaries. Well, man, if you're not practicing the law, you're an adversary.
Right. It also says, you know, if you break these laws again, it's like sacrificing Yahshua anew, too.
Right, exactly. Very good.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
For our doing wrong voluntarily.
Yes.
After receiving the knowledge of the truth.
Mm-hmm.
No longer for wrongdoing does a sacrifice remain.
Yes, yes.
In other words, you've trashed the sacrifice of Yahshua Christ on the cross.
Right.
And you don't get another one.
Yeah, and no, you can't sacrifice a chicken to make it right.
Right, it's done, it's over with.
Yeah.
A certain fearful expectation of judgment,
right. Yeah.
And a fervent fire destined to devour the opposition.
Right, so in other words,
instead of being able to make another sacrifice.
Yeah. So and rather than this being interpreted as the universal, and the antinomians do, saying that, okay, you don't have to worry about sacrifice, it's all been done away with, and, you know, the law's been done away with. Paul's saying exactly the opposite here. He's saying, you better take this seriously now because you don't have these sacrifices to fall back on anymore.
Right. Yahweh is basically saying, hey, all of your sacrifices for all of these centuries were no good to me.
Yeah.
I'm going to do it myself.
Right.
And I'm not going to screw it up.
Right.
If you go screw it up again, you ain't got nothing coming.
Right, right. Yeah. Okay.
That's basically what it boils down to.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So we're in trouble if we deem ourselves lawbreakers and can, you know, do whatever we please. Okay, verse 28.
Wait a second.
Yes.
Over here in Matthew 16:26-27, he says, for what is a man profited if he gains all the world and loses his own life? On what shall a man give in exchange for his life?
Yes.
The son of Adam is going to come in the esteem of his father with his messengers, and then he shall reward each according to his works.
Yes.
And yeah. That's why we've got to be so careful about what we do.
Yeah, that's right. That's
and,
right.
And we have to follow what he's told us here.
But those antinomians, they disregard that language, and they prefer to use their false interpretations of the New Testament to pretend that we don't have to do good works.
Blind leaders of the blind.
That's right. That's absolutely right. Verse 28. He that despised Moses' law died without mercy under two or three witnesses. In other words, he who committed offenses, you know, a punishment unto death, died without mercy.
Right. Well, the thing, you know, this is where they have confusion on grace. They believe that when Yahshua came, that we moved from the law of grace. All we did is move from the law of sin and death into the law of sin and grace.
Right. Exactly. Very well put. Very well put. Verse 29, of how much sore punishment suppose you shall he be thought worthy who has trodden underfoot the Son of God and has counted the blood of the covenant wherewith he was sanctified an unholy thing and has done despite to the Spirit of grace. Bill, translate, please.
How much more severe a punishment do you suppose he who is trampled upon the Son of Yahweh would be accounted worthy, and who regarded as common the blood of the covenant in which he was sanctified, and who insulted the spirit of that favor?
Okay.
In other words, first he says, one who sets aside a law of Moses without compassion by two or three witnesses is put to death.
Yes.
So the people who trample the sacrifice of Christ and regard it as common or as nothing.
Or disregard it, yes.
Right. They're going to be punished much more severely than those who set aside the laws of Moses.
Right.
And don't.
Again, exact opposite of what the universalists teach.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Better take this stuff seriously, you guys. This means you. Okay, verse 30. For we know him that has said, vengeance belongs to me, I will recompense, says Yahweh. And again, Yahweh shall judge his people. Verse 31. And if there's no law, how can he judge us, right? Verse 31.
And recompense is payment in return for breaking the law.
There you go. There you go. Verse 31. It is go ahead.
If there's no law, then there's no recompense, is there?
Right. Right, absolutely. Verse 31, it is a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. Oh, boy, are we in trouble. Verse 32, but call to remembrance the former days in which after you were illuminated, you endured a great fight of afflictions. And, of course, we're doing that all the time. And the more we understand the Holy Scriptures, the more we appreciate our afflictions. Verse 33, partly, go ahead.
In verse 31, there's more to that, too.
Okay.
These Edomites and these proselytes, these evildoers today that are trying to come against Yahweh's anointed, they better take heed to verse 31.
Right. Absolutely.
That's to do with them, too. It's a fearful thing.
Yeah,
to
right.
fall into the hands of the living Yahweh. And who shall, touch not my anointed and do my prophets no harm?
Yes. Yes.
Because we don't have to do anything. He will take care of our enemies.
Right. Yeah, well, as long as we, we walk the walk, and
right.
not just talk the talk, we have to set the example.
Yeah.
And that, setting example requires behavior, and it requires love and brotherly love.
That precise example that Ken just gave, that's why in 1 Corinthians chapter 5, Paul tells us to put the sinners outside of the assembly, and that doesn't mean the assembly on Sunday afternoon.
Right.
That means to take the sinners and put them out of your community.
Hey, Bill.
We'll judge them.
They're letting the sinners into the assembly on Sunday afternoon.
Right. It's crazy.
Yes, absolutely. Okay, verse 33. Partly while you were made a gazing stock by reproaches and afflictions, and partly while you became companions of them that were so used. In other words, well, and it's true of our people today. We've become a laughing stock. The great apostasy is upon all of Christendom. They're perceived as hypocrites for saying one thing and doing another, and we've become a laughing stock because they have totally misinterpreted the Holy Word.
Right. Here, Paul means to say the afflictions that they suffered during the deportations to Assyria and Babylon.
Right, right. But even so, symbolically, we're still going through that.
Oh, absolutely.
And our people simply do not understand this clear language. And they teach the exact opposite of what it's saying. Okay, verse 34. For you had compassion of me in my bonds and took joyfully the spoiling of your goods, knowing in yourself that you have in heaven a better and an enduring substance. In other words, you made personal sacrifices on my behalf.
You had compassion with me in my bonds. I'm not reading that.
Okay, well,
I have my translation up here. So you also sympathized with the prisoners.
Okay.
It has nothing to do with Paul himself. I'm sorry.
Okay, well, that's the way, you know, this is the King James, and this King James just reads in a confusing manner in a lot of Paul's writings. So,
oh, yeah.
Today I chose the King James, and I've been reading from the Moffat translation because his translation is simply better. Okay, verse 35. Cast not away, therefore, your confidence, which has great recompense of reward. Okay, now, reward. Doesn't the reward require that we do something to gain, to achieve the reward or gain it?
And my translation says, do not then lose your boldness, which has great reward.
Okay. So we have to earn it. A reward is something that you earn.
You know, there's a word that the King James translators abuse this word everywhere, and I could write an essay on this, on the way they treated this word.
Okay.
And here they translate it twice, boldness.
Yeah.
But the word parousia means free-spokenness or liberty.
Okay.
It means basically it encompasses the Greek idea of freedom of speech.
Right.
And that it's not boldness, it's liberty.
Uh-huh.
And the church wanted to teach, the church would never grant its members liberty.
Yes.
The Anglican Church, the Roman Church, oh no, they never wanted you to think you had liberty.
Right.
You were in bondage to them.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that word boldness really irks me.
And when the King James Version was being translated, there was strife between the Protestants and the Catholics still, okay? And even the Protestants, they were oppressing their own people who didn't agree with, you know, King James, okay? And so you can see why that, you know, the ill-chosen words here, okay? And the politics of the day had a lot to do with it.
Right. I'm sure they did.
Yes, absolutely.
That okay. Counts.
All right, verse 36, for you have need of patience, that after you have done the will of God, you might receive the promise. Now, how can you put it any plainer?
Well, I got it plainer than that.
Okay.
This says, you have need of
endurance.
Pardon me. That doing the will of Yahweh, you recover the promise.
Okay.
Not receive,
yes.
Recover.
Okay.
That word is a word which specifically means recover.
All right.
And it's going back again to the Old Testament.
Mm-hmm.
That this promise is for the Israelites and nobody else.
Right.
And
right.
They take that word and they translate it receive.
Yes. Okay.
And it definitely means recover.
Yes. But the essential point is that you have to do the will of God in order to receive the promise.
Yeah.
Nowhere.
Yeah.
Can you,
well, absolutely, but my I'm just trying to take it a step further and
yes.
Say that you better be an Israelite doing the will of God.
Uh-huh. Yeah, okay.
Receive the promise.
Yeah. And still, but nevertheless, the antinomians will swear up and down that the law is done away with and you do not have to do the will of God to receive the promise.
That word receive they put there is like what Bill's pointing out is that can mean anybody.
Right, I see. Okay, yeah. But still, I'm arguing against antinomianism here. You know, those people who say the law has been done away with and we don't have to do anything to receive our reward. It's been foreordained no matter what you do. That's
right.
What they teach. And you cannot reconcile that teaching with verse 36. Okay, verse 37. For yet a little while, and he that shall come will come and will not tarry. This is going to happen, folks, and there's nothing going to stop it. Verse 38. Now the just shall live by faith, but if any man draw back, my soul shall have no pleasure in him. Now, of course, by faith, we are talking the faith of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and not the so-called faith of the modern apostate churches, right?
Well, the word here, I think, is belief is what I've got.
Okay.
I've got something different, but belief. Is again, it's the belief in what he's told us.
Right.
It's not just our faith, but it's belief.
Right.
Whole different meaning there.
Yes. Well, it's certainly, again, putting this in historical context, Paul is talking to people who have lived this faith, this belief, you know, but he's just trying to explain to them that there's been a slight change, there's been a slight modification, as you put it very well earlier, that it's no longer sacrifices and retribution. It's the law and grace coming together, okay? Mercy. Bill, any comments from you?
Yeah, the whole epistle to the Hebrews is trying to explain to the Hebrews that this time has come that the Levitical priesthood and the sacrifices and the rituals are now done away with, as the Old Testament scriptures said that they would be.
Right, right.
And the whole epistles are geared to convince them of that. And to point that out to them.
Right. And certainly, Paul really is the only messenger of the New Testament who is going to great lengths to explain this. There may be bits and pieces of it in the other authors, but Paul is really making a point to explain this, isn't he?
Absolutely. And off the top of my head, I would say that James and Peter didn't really get into that at all.
Right.
That I can remember.
Yeah. And so that's why the epistles of Paul seem to be different, because he's stressing, and he's quoted twice, Jeremiah 31 twice in the book of Hebrews, that to stress the fact that this is what he is indeed talking about, and he's not talking about doing away with the entire law. He's talking about the fulfillment of the promises.
Right, and the fact that James didn't discuss that is evident. I think it's in Acts chapter 20 or 21 where James has Paul go to the temple and make a sacrifice.
Right.
And Paul accedes to James. He goes ahead and does it, and I believe he only did it because James was his elder.
Right, right.
And Paul was being obedient to his elder,
uh-huh.
which was his responsibility, his
right.
obligation.
Right, yeah. And obviously, Paul recognized that this is a transition period, and I think we talked about how long this transition period would take. And certainly the Christianization of the dispersed Israelites who had, you know, that took, what, 1,000 years?
Oh, yeah, and there's 30 years in the book of Acts.
Right.
And a lot of people don't realize that.
That's right. Exactly. Okay, one more verse in chapter 10, verse 39. But we are not of them who draw back to perdition, but of them that believe to the saving of the soul. In other words, it's still possible to draw back to perdition. And you have to behave properly. You have to love your brethren. You have to obey the commandments of Yahweh. Otherwise, you fall back into perdition. Not so?
Absolutely.
Yeah, this translation says, but we are not of those who draw back to destruction.
Uh-huh.
But of belief to the preservation of life, and how we're going to preserve our life.
Right, right.
Through obedience.
Yes, absolutely. All right, so we've got three more chapters of the book of Hebrews to go, and it's been quite an experience. I thank you both for being my guests again today on Yahweh's Covenant People. And I think we're making the point very clear that the great apostasy of Christendom has totally misrepresented not just the words of Paul, but the Old Testament and the New Testament in every possible conceivable way. I think you put it best a couple of shows ago, Bill. They took the baton and ran over the cliff with it. You said something to that effect, and that's what they've done.
Absolutely,
yeah.
They dismissed the whole New Testament to teach what they think things should be run. It's crazy.
Yeah, it's absolutely crazy. All right, okay, gentlemen, thank you for joining me again today. Looking forward again to next Saturday. We'll probably do two more shows on the Book of Hebrews. And to complete the thinking, and then we can discuss, you know, where we want to go next, into which book of the New Testament following that show, okay? So, ladies and gentlemen, I hope you have enjoyed tonight's broadcast of Yahweh's Covenant People. We'll be seeing again next week, next Saturday night. We'll do another show about the book of Hebrews. And please join us again and tell your friends that we're doing this. And explaining the New Testament from the Christian identity point of view, and that it totally refutes the pervasive influence of the Judeo-Christian pulpits that are teaching nothing but error in the name of Yahweh and actually blaspheming every time they get up on the pulpit. That's what they're really doing, folks. So, okay, thank you, Bill. Thank you, Ken. Look forward to seeing you and talking with you again next Saturday night.
Praise Yahweh.
Praise Yahweh. Okay. And Yahweh bless everybody. I will be on again tomorrow at noon Eastern. I will be talking about how the 1960s were the opening of Pandora's box, the fornications of Mystery Babylon came upon America with a vengeance in the 1960s. So if you can tune in tomorrow, please join me. Yahweh bless everybody.